The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org. Look for the Conferences tab. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
If you don't have the handout, just raise your hand and Ryan will pass them out to you. Whoa. I want to get started right away because I timed this last night and it took exactly 60 minutes. So plan on being here the whole time. For introduction, I want to let you know that I have been observing teachers, whether in the public school, which I was in for about 18 years, or in the private school, or with student teachers for about 37 years. And it is amazing that I see the same things happening over and over, the same mistakes that we make. And I have made them all many, many times. But when I go into classrooms, I tend to see these five things. And when I was asked to speak, I thought, oh, perfect opportunity. I've got to share this with you all. Because even though we tend to make these same five mistakes over and over, they're just very easy to correct. So let's get started. The five mistakes, and you don't need to copy these because if you have the handout, they'll be written down as we go through it. But the five mistakes are telling rather than teaching, trying to teach without a management system in place, not monitoring and adjusting when necessary and throughout the lesson, giving unclear directions, and not really knowing what a task analysis is or how to use it. If I ever do this again, I will not follow Matt Whitling. I listened to him and I thought, whoa, he's got the audience in their hand. There's all this laughing. It's just so much fun. And I'm thinking what I'm presenting and I'm thinking, this is serious stuff. How does he do this? So next year, or if I ever do this again, I will be first and not second. Now, first mistake, telling instead of teaching. Just what it sounds like. What you're doing is you have the rules at the beginning of the school year, you post them, you might read over them, and that's it. That is telling. You tell about the kings of the Old Testament. This happens so much in the secondary, but it happens in the grammar oftentimes too. You have 50 minutes. And you want to get as much packed into that 50 minutes as possible. And so often we think, okay, if we lecture, if we tell the whole 50 minutes, we're covering more material. Or same with reading a story in the Bible. You'll read through the whole story in the Bible, telling the students, not teaching. Or when you have a video and you show the entire video and then you do something at the end of the video. All of this is telling and it's not teaching. The difference between telling and teaching is active participation. And to ensure learning, you've got to get the students involved. You have to get them involved in lots of different ways. I ran this presentation over with my teachers at Providence up in near Seattle, Washington. And one thing they said is they want to be able to focus on me instead of writing notes. So I put the answers in red to make it really easy for you. Active participation, number one influence in learning. So if you use active participation a lot, get the kids involved with the learning, then you are increasing their learning. It's so important to have the kids involved. It's been proven in study after study that the more you involve the students in the learning, the more learning will take place. And the ideal is 50% teacher talk and 50% student talk. And you might think that's a lot, but if you're doing this correctly, it's easy to get them involved in the lesson. When we lecture the students, when all we do is lecture, and think about it in your college classes, you know, you go in, you hear them for 50 minutes, 60 minutes, and then you leave. When we do that, the students learn 10% of what you're giving them. That means you've presented this wonderful, wonderful lesson plan. It's got all these great things in it, all this great information. You feed it into their mind, and out goes 90% of what you've said. They only remember 10%. So what we as teachers have to do is we need to see how we get the students involved. It's like right now, I made a handout for all of you to fill in the blanks. Well, you having to fill the blanks in is helping to increase the learning and helping to increase what you're going to remember about what I have to say today. So, and every time we do something, we raise that percentage of what they're going to keep in their head. So the question is, when do we involve the students and how do we involve the students? And the when is consistently. You need to do it throughout every single lesson. And if you, when you're doing your lesson plans, write in your lesson plans when you're going to involve the student and how you're going to involve the student, then that's going to help you to remember to get this active participation. And the key to active participation is not to let it be voluntary. You've got to be able to call on all the students in the class at different times. And that's why so many of you, especially at the grammar level, you have those clothespins with their names on it and you pick one name at a time. It's important to get all of the students involved. For those of you that came in late, there is a handout. The amount of active participation tells you essentially how good your lesson is and how much the students are going to be learning. Learning is active, it's not passive. And as I mentioned earlier, I think active participation is the number one thing on learning. So if you don't do anything else in your teaching, if you're a new teacher and you're learning one thing this year, this is the thing you want to learn. Now, there's two different ways that you can involve the students. You can involve them covertly or overtly. Both are equally good. Covertly, and you use this especially in the grades higher, fourth, fifth, sixth, and above, is you might say to the students, imagine if, and then when you do that, allow some wait time. Or you might say, consider this. Think about this. There's different things you can do to involve them so that to get them involved in the lesson. Now, I think many of us already do the covert. We ask the students as a whole when we're doing the reviewing math at the beginning and we give them a problem. You know, what's 8 plus 2 minus 3 plus 5 times 2? You know, we're asking them and then you get the whole class to give you an answer. And or if you're in Shirley Grammar and you're doing the jingles, you're having them all do it together. There's also you can write down the answer. We have whiteboards at our school for all of the grammar grades, and it is so wonderful to have those little white square boards. And whether it's math or Shirley or reading or whatever you do, they can jot the answer down, hold it up, and you can see right away that they know it, that they don't know it, but what they're doing is they're actively participating. And then many of you, you can ask questions, and thumbs up is the yes, thumbs down is the no. There's different signals that you can do. So there's many different ways to involve them overtly. One of the things that we sometimes forget to do as teachers is at the end of the lesson, one of the seven laws say we need to review. And so you've taught this beautiful lesson, you've actively involved them throughout the lesson, but at the end of the lesson, so often we as teachers, we sum up what we've just taught. And it's really important that instead of us summing up, we need to let the students sum up, because if we do, then we know that they've got what we've taught them. Okay, right now, I would like all of you to just take a moment and tell somebody next to you. I want you to think about this for a moment first. Think about something you learned about active participation that you didn't know before, and then share it with a neighbor. Just take a moment to do that. Okay, thank you. It's hard. We as teachers, I think as teachers, we tend to not have enough time to talk with colleagues. So once you get started, it's hard to stop, but we're going to move on. All right, the second mistake we tend to make is teaching without a management system in place. The law of the learner says that the student must attend with interest to the material to be learned, but it's our job to teach them how to listen. And to do that, we've got to have our management system in place. If they've not been taught how to attend, you get talking and different things going on throughout the lesson. So you've got to find a way to keep their attention, to get their attention, and then to keep it. What do I see in the classroom? When I come to observe in the classrooms, and I do that on a daily basis, what do I see that shows that you don't have a good management system in place? Number one, you're talking over the kids. Whether it's one student or the whole room of students, you're talking over the students. Or some of the students might be off task, playing with their things in their desk or jabbing their neighbor or whatever. Like we just covered, the teacher doesn't teach the rules, they just tell the rules. Or, and this is really common, if you have a lack of organization in your classroom, oftentimes that transfers over to not having good classroom management. And classroom management is just what it takes to run your classroom. Something else I see that if you are not, if you haven't got a good management system, is that you're being proactive rather than reactive. You're waiting till Johnny gets in trouble to do something about the classroom management, or you're waiting till Jennifer and passes a note over here, or you see some problem in the classroom and then you're reacting. Or poor pacing. If your pacing is so slow that it gives kids the time to be off task, that is also going to cause classroom management problems. So how do you get and keep the students' attention? You've got to teach them the daily routines, the expectations in the classroom, and you've always got to focus on being proactive rather than reactive. Good teachers always reinforce good behavior. Now, how do you teach them the expectations? Number one thing is you've got to know what the expectations are that you want to have in your classroom. And it depends what grade level you are. All grade levels in pre-K through sixth grade at our school, they have to be taught how to line up correctly. And you might think that's an easy process if you're a brand new teacher. You just, you know, Matt Whitling just did his talk on, and he covered the lining up, how it has to be straight, and how you have to come to line up quickly, and different variations in it. There can be so many steps just in teaching students how to line up properly, how to sharpen their pencils, how to go to the bathroom, you know, how they behave in the restroom. How they go get a drink of water, what they do with their water bottle, how they put their books in their desk and get them out of their desk. There's so many different things. You know, all these things here, you've got to identify what's important to you and your classroom. And it there's a list of 10 things here, and these are all the things that you need to teach those first couple of weeks of school and keep reinforcing throughout the year. Now, how do you do it? You have your list. The first thing you do is you make your list of the things that are important in your classroom. That's the number one thing you do. Then you've got to prioritize the order you want to teach these desired behaviors. You can't teach everything the first day. And especially in kindergarten, pre-K, first grade, it takes, you know, you might get through one thing a day, maybe two things a day. And there's all of these that you need to do. Now, after you have identified what you want to teach, and then you've prioritized the order you want to teach them in, the third thing you have to do is a task analysis on the desired behavior. Now, many of you don't have the speakeasy language of knowing what a task analysis is. What that is you've got your objective, and the task analysis is all the steps to accomplishing that objective. We know that an objective is what you want the students to know at the end of the lesson that they don't know at the beginning of the lesson. So what you're doing is you're taking all the steps in teaching that. And you're doing that for all 10 of those things or 12 of those things or however many things that you want to teach the students so that you can have good classroom management. We all know that to teach the desired behaviors, there are certain steps we do. If you have taught even a year, you know the first thing you always do when you teach is you have a set. You tell the kids the reason for learning, and you especially tell that in grades fourth grade and above. If they have a reason in their mind that I have to learn this, then they're going to do it more often. In the lower grades, you can just start the teaching right away. It helps if you have a set, but you don't need that as much. When you go to teach, like lining up or how you sharpen your pencil or whatever you do, the next thing you have to do is you have to think of all the steps in your task analysis. Then you model the behavior. You show them what good lining up looks like. You show them exactly what you expect. You can show that with students, or you can show that by you doing it, but you've got to model that behavior, and then you do the step-by-step, each step in the task analysis. And when you do that, it is so important that after each step, you check for understanding to make sure they understand and they're with you. And then you practice it. That's good teaching, and I think we all know that. Now, how do you keep the students' attention? How do you keep them so they're always lining up just like you want them to? How do you keep them so that every time they take out their Shirley Grammar book, workbook, or they take out their something out of their desk and they get ready and get in sitting position, you've got to consistently remind them, not remind them what to do, but consistently praise them when they do it well. And you need good transitions. One thing that we as teachers tend to do is we'll say, okay, we're sitting in that math group for calendar time at the beginning of the day, and we have to transition them to their desk. We need to teach them those transitions. But after we've taught them the transition, we also need to be teaching during the transition. And this is so important because you may think a transition takes 1, 2, 3 minutes. Well, if you add that up throughout the day, and especially in the lower grades where you're only teaching in 20-minute segments, that can add up to a lot of time. And we want there to be teaching going on and getting as much out of the day as possible. So when you do a transition, in fact, I heard a talk yesterday from someone at Tall Oaks, and they were saying that some of the teachers have the kids do a chant or one of the jingles or even sing a song in transition so that they're doing something. Because if the students are doing something during the transition, then they're not going to be off task. They're going to be easy for you once they're sitting down to call them to the task at hand. Something that you might want to do too, if you don't want them singing or chanting or whatever, you might give them something to do. You're going from your your calendar time at the beginning to sitting down at the desk and you're going to start your Shirley grammar. And you might say, okay, class, what I want you to do is three things. I want you to walk over to your desk. I want you to get out your book. And then I want you to head your paper. And then I want you to read the first paragraph in the book. So you've got them, they've got in their mind, I've got to do these three things. And so they're going to stay on task with you, and you're not going to have to call them back with you. There's not going to be time for talking. There's not going to be time for George to be punching his neighbor. They're just right with you. Something else you want to do is, even though you've taught the rules, it's such a good idea to review them weekly, especially the first couple months of school, because grammar kids, especially in the K through 3 grades, they need that constant review. And one thing you want to remember, too, is when you're thinking about your classroom management and you're thinking about being proactive rather than reactive, you want to continually be standing up. Don't ever just sit in front of the classroom or even standing up in front of the classroom. You want to be moving continually. You know those students. You know George's tendencies. You know over here that Jennifer and Rachel have problems talking. You know this about these kids. So to be proactive, you're going to be always walking around, standing by George when you think he might have a temptation, going over here and standing by Jennifer because you know what her temptations are. And knowing that class, you can be really proactive in your classroom management so that they aren't getting in trouble. You're not having to get after them because you've done your job of trying to see ahead of time what's going to happen. Now, I want you to think about your classroom management. Think about the things, you know, you got a new year coming up. Think about the things that you want to teach your kids before school begins, and think about everything that you might need to do in regards to classroom management. This is just one piece of your teaching and what you have to do to get ready. But I want you to think right now about two things that you learned about classroom management that you could apply to your teaching, to your school year. I don't want to get you talking again. It takes too long to get you back. Okay, the third thing, the mistake that we tend to do as teachers is not monitoring and adjusting throughout the lesson when necessary. We've made this wonderful lesson plan. We have it in our mind that we have 50 minutes for this class. We're going to go through each step of our lesson plan. We're going to actively involve the students. But the next thing you have to remember to do is to monitor the students, to make sure that they are with you. And good teaching always involves complex decision making. It involves decision making before you teach, while you're teaching, and after you teach. Just no matter what you're teaching, that is just really important. Law number 4 tells us not to be vague and to make sure the students understand completely before moving on to the lesson. I believe that I believe that as teachers, one of our most important jobs is to make sure the students are successful. Yes, they have to attend and pay attention and be with us and all of that, but it's our job to make sure that they're learning. And why is this so important? It's important because the first time you teach them, you've got to make sure that you're accurate, not in your teaching, but that they've got what you've taught them. Because so often, you can raise your hand if you need a handout. You're teaching them something and you're thinking it's going right into that little brain of theirs, but sometimes going to that brain, it can kind of be distorted and they can think they have it, but instead of having it, they're completely off base. And that's why it's important that we monitor and find out what they got before we continue on with our teaching. Because it's so difficult once they've got something in their head to, and just an example, if you say 2 + 2 = 4, you think, okay, they've got it. 2 + 2 = 4. You've got your manipulatives here, and 2 + 2 = 4. But I pick on George because he's one that I know very well. George might have over here that, and he used, instead of 2 manipulatives + 2, he used 2 + 3. So he's got in his mind that 2 + 2 = 5. So he has this in his mind, and once he has it, it's so hard to change it. So you've got to do the teaching and check to make sure that they're with you before you move on. And teachers don't know if their students really know what they're teaching them unless they check for understanding. And I remember my first few years as an administrator, and I was at the junior high level. And this was in the public school, and I was just arguing with teachers over and over, because they would say, Phil Lowe would always say, I know that they're with me. I can tell if they're with me. I can tell if they've got it. I can tell by the expression on their face. You know, I just know my students so well that I know when they get it. Well, you don't know. Think of yourself in a class. You know, sometime during your life, you've been in a lecture where it's been really boring. But you don't want the teacher to feel bad, so you have eye contact and you pay attention. But in the back of your mind, you're thinking of your grocery list, or you're thinking about what's the next workshop I'm going to go to, or, you know, a myriad of things. But you're really good. I mean, we're adults. We have learned it very well to have the teacher think that you're paying attention. Well, students learn this too. They learn the expectations, you know, the shaking the head, the things like that. And they know how to fool you. So you've got to check for understanding, to monitor and make sure that they are with you. Whom do we monitor? Checking for behavior means that we are looking or listening at as many answers as possible. And if you don't have time to call on all the students, you call on a good sample. We as teachers, especially when we have visitors in the classroom, we as teachers tend to call on the high students. High students make us look really good. You ask the question, they know the answer, and you're thinking, wow, I really taught that well. But what we need to do is call on those lower students, because if the lower students don't know it, we need to reteach or do something to call them in, especially if the learning is sequential and they need to know this before going on to the next step. One thing I want to caution you too, though, don't always just call on the low students, because the students will pick up on that. You call on the low students, you call on some middle, and fewer of the high students. You've got to call on all of them, but make sure when you're checking, when you're teaching new material, you check with those low students. Now, when do we monitor? We monitor frequently. I talked to you about what a task analysis is. You have different steps in the task analysis. In the grades pre-K through 3, after every single step of the task analysis, you want to check for understanding. Make sure that they are with you, monitoring that and keeping close tabs on them. The older the student is, the less frequently you have to check for understanding. If you have a 20-minute lesson, you might be checking for understanding 10 different times in that lesson if you are in the lower grades. If you're in 4th, 5th, or 6th, you're probably going to check maybe 6 to 7 times. You know, you do less times, but the more you check, the more you're with you, the more that you know that they're with you, and your pacing can be better because you can be moving on with your lesson. I talked earlier about how we monitor the choral responding, signal for the answer, writing the answer down, discussing it with a buddy, and using wait or think time. All of these are different ways, overtly and covertly, that we can monitor, check for understanding. Now, one of my pet peeves is that at the end of the lesson, or even in the middle of the lesson, you don't ask the kids, do you understand? You know, which one of us want to sound dumb in front of all of our peers and say, oh no, I don't understand? You can't, you don't do that. You have to check for the understanding. And once you've checked for the understanding, then you can say, are there any questions? But don't ask, do you understand? Sorry. Now, once you've checked for understanding, you've done that throughout the lesson, you monitored the lesson, it's going well. If it's going well, you have to make a decision, one of several decisions. If it's going well, your decision will be to keep going on with the lesson. But if you check for understanding and you find out the kids aren't with you, you've got to think to yourself, do I just toss it and not do anything about it? And that's the tendency most of us have. We want to just keep going on with our lesson and make sure we finish what we've planned on teaching. But, and sometimes you can just toss it. You can just think, I don't need to worry about that, even though the kids don't have it. You know, in Saxon math, they teach some concept just as an introduction, not for mastery. And they'll get to that the next year. So sometimes you can just skip it. And if a few kids didn't get it, you know, don't worry about it. But, or you might think, I'm going to, they don't have that. I don't have time to finish it today. I've got to go on to something else. But I'm going to pick it up tomorrow and reteach it at the beginning of my lesson before I start the next math lesson. All of this is done with the goal of maintaining your momentum and your pacing in your lesson, because you want it to go really smoothly. Now, checking for understanding. You know, I said earlier that active participation is the first thing that you want to do. If you don't remember anything else, that's the number one thing you want to remember in your teaching. The second thing is checking for understanding or monitoring throughout the lesson. Those two things are so important. And I'd like you to just think about those two right now and think of an instance when you taught in the past where perhaps you didn't do that as well and how you could do it better. If you'll just do that for a moment. Can't have you talk. Sorry. I didn't figure the talking time in on my presentation time. Okay, the fourth mistake is giving unclear directions. There's two main things that I see when I go into a classroom that show me that your directions weren't the best. Number one, you give directions to the students and they start working as you told them to do, and a minute or two later you think, oh, I forgot to tell them that. So you interrupt the class and you say to them, okay, class, need your attention for a moment, eyes here, and then you give them another direction. They start working again. 5 minutes later you think, oh yeah, they need to know this in order to finish this. So you interrupt them again, give them another direction. I've done that. I know. You know, sometimes you just don't think of every direction that you need to give them. But what you're doing is not really giving good directions. And the other thing that I see that shows that you're not giving good directions is you'll give the directions, you'll think they're ready to start, and right away, before anybody starts, you have three or four hands that go up asking for clarification. Is this what you're saying, Mrs. England? Is this what you're saying? Is this what you mean? And so both of those things, if that's ever happened to you, what it's telling you is your directions were not the best. Because, like I said earlier, our job is to make sure the students are successful. And to make sure they're successful, they need to have it so clear in their mind. How do you make it clear in their mind? Four things that you have to do. Number one, you need to be really clear on your task analysis. So that means if you have ever done one of the two things, or if you do that consistently, you want to have a really good task analysis on your direction giving. So if you've done that and you've done it a lot and it's a problem, you're going to take time to write your directions out. And if you'd have to do this for a week or two, you know, take the time to do that so that you can have really clear directions and you're not forgetting parts of them. And what I do is you write your directions the day before, and then as you're thinking about them until the next day, sometimes it'll come to your mind, oh, I forgot this, and you can add that to your task analysis on giving directions. Also, after you've written out your directions, you put them in order. Sometimes they don't need to be in order. Many times they do need to be in order. There's some kind of sequence they need to be. If your directions are more than two, you need to number them. Because when things are numbered, students are going to remember them better. Now, in regards to numbering, you want to make sure if you are in grades pre-K through 3, you do not ever give more than two directions without checking for understanding to make sure they're with you. So you've given two directions and you say, hey, Ryan, could you tell me what the first direction was? You know, Jennifer, can you tell me what the second direction is? And if you do that, after every two directions, they'll tend to remember it longer. If the students are older, you can give them more directions. You could give them maybe four directions and then check for understanding. I had a teacher last year who is no longer with us that she would give 10 directions to first graders. And they were supposed to do all these, and there would be no checking for understanding. And she totally lost them, because even us as adults, when she was giving these directions and I was listening to them, I was thinking to myself, wow, I can't remember what they are. And I have a pencil and paper and I'm trying to write them down. So I've had the added benefit of not only having those directions given to me orally, but I've been writing them down. And if I had to remember all 10, I might be able to get 5. So it's so important in our direction giving that we give a few, however many, according to their age level, and then check for understanding. We number them because they then can give them back to you when you're checking, and they can do that easier. Now, for those of you, I'm going to try this again. Find a neighbor and tell a couple of things that you can do to give better directions than you have been giving. Okay, our last item and our last mistake is not knowing what a task analysis is or how to use it. I wasn't going to have this be my fifth one. I was going to be talking about how to write a good objective. But I had a teacher at school that said that she has learned so much about task analysis this year and it's made such a difference in her teaching that I thought I would add this instead. We talked about, you know, earlier what it is. What a task analysis does is, number one, it describes all the learnings that are necessary for a student to accomplish the objective. How many of you actually write out your objectives every day? Do any of you? Okay. Yeah, the longer we teach, the more we can do it just in our mind. But it's always good to just jot down the objective and if there's anything that we're struggling with, like giving directions or something, to write those out. Also, the task analysis describes the specific task, just very specifically what you need to do in your teaching. The first two things there are very similar. And it sets forth the whole lesson in small incremental steps. And this is so good that it does it because it makes it good stopping points to know when you should check for understanding. At the very beginning of this workshop, I talked to you about things that I, on telling instead of teaching, things that you do. And one of them is showing a film and then at the end, you know, going over questions and everything. It is so much more effective in your task analysis if you're going to be showing a film to think of two or three questions that you proposed, you put on the board or put somewhere, that these are the things, students, that I want you to look for while you're watching the film. It's even better if you write it on a piece of paper and say, okay, I want you to be looking for these three things while you're watching the film and jot down, you know, some of your thoughts on these. Because when you wait until the end of the film, you might have 20 minutes, 30 minutes have gone by, and they're just watching and enjoying. They're not really picking out the information that you want them to pick out. Okay, so how do you do the task analysis? First, you list all the learnings that need to take place to teach that objective. And if you leave one out, you're going to find out right away after you started teaching it, because the kids will not be able to do something, and all of a sudden you'll remember, oh, I need to be sure that that's part of the teaching too. Some of the learnings are going to be dependent on each other, so they have to be in a certain order, so sometimes you have to order these things. It's important, too, that you eliminate all of the learnings, all the things in your lesson plan, in your objective, in this task analysis that aren't important. It's so much easier for the students if you are teaching something. And, you know, some teachers really want to make it more interesting, so they'll pull in this, and they'll pull in this, and they'll pull in this. Well, pretty soon you've got so much in this one objective that the students can't really figure out what's important and what's not important. And some of you may have found ways to let them know that, yes, it's nice to know that George Washington did this, but if it doesn't fit in with the objective, you're kind of clouding things. So it really is important to take out those things that aren't important in teaching this objective. And then once you've taught your objective, you know they've got it because you've checked for understanding. If you want to put in those extra things because you have time, do so, you know, to make the learning more interesting. But it makes it easier for the students if you just stick with the objective. The first year I started working at a classical school, I heard Matt Whitling speak. And one thing that stuck with me, and he told the same story today, I absolutely loved it, about the third grade when he, the Latin teacher would be teaching, and he taught the kids that when they finish their Latin that they have to be ready for their lit class. They have to have their Latin book put away. They have to have their lit book out, open to the right page. And they could do that without him being in the classroom. And I heard that, and I thought, wow, that's how I would love for all my teachers to be able to train their kids in classroom management where they can do something like that. And I have many good teachers that can do that right now. And our sixth grade teacher is, she has done this for lunch. And the whole thing is their lunch routine. And all they're doing is, for a 15-minute period, it's what you do to get ready for lunch, and what then she reads to them, and what you do at the end of lunch. So that for that 15 minutes, she has a 10-step task analysis on what they do. But because she has done this, because she has broken the learnings into small parts, because she has taught those learnings, you know, a couple, two or three at a time, made sure they have it, because she's modeled it, because she's gone through this over and over and really got it down, She cannot even be in the classroom during lunchtime, and these things will work beautifully. I had a sub in there once, and they came afterwards and told me that they've never seen anything like this in their whole life. All they did was sit at the desk while the students did everything to get ready for lunch. But first thing they did is the teacher concludes the lesson and has the students clear their desk. Student helper hands out baby wipes as the class sings the table blessing. As the wipes are passed out, the students wash their hands and then their desk. The wipes are kept at desk to be used for cleanup when the lunch is finished. Student or the teacher leads the class in prayer. Now, all these things seem, some of them just seem like, well, yeah, that's going to happen. But you really need to teach these things if you want your class to be running very, very well. And then she adds to that, the students stand up, push in their chairs, and they're dismissed by rows to get their lunchbox. Student holds open the door. As they file out, they get their lunchboxes. And instead of just all coming back in at the same time, they line up in reverse order to re-enter the classroom. The door holder opens the door, the students re-enter the classroom and eat while the teacher reads, and at the end of lunch, one student takes picks up all the trash around the room and the wipes, throws it away, and all the students pick their chairs up, and then their class is dismissed, except for the students whose job it is to sweep the floor. All that for 15 minutes, but because she has done that, because she has taught that so well, that class can run without her being in the classroom. And that's an example of an excellent task analysis. I want you to think for just a moment. Think about washing your car, okay? Think about all the steps you do when you go to wash your car. I was thinking to myself, what I need to do if I were to do a good task analysis in that. And, you know, you think that, okay, I've got to go get the bucket, I've got to get the sponge, and I've got to get the soapy stuff that you put in it. Then the second step on the task analysis is I have to go out and I have to rinse the car off. Then I take the sponge and I wash sections of the car, this section first, this section third, fourth, and so forth. Then I rinse the car after each section. Then I do the next section. And then when I finish, I take this cloth that my husband bought and I dry it off. And then I use Windex and I clean the windows. Okay, there's 8 things just to washing a car. And some of those things aren't even important to me. You know, I thought it was really silly to rinse the car off with the hose before you even use the water to wash it. But I didn't do that one time, and my husband let me know this is really an important step in the task analysis of washing the car. So it's something I don't forget anymore. But just everything you do, you're doing a task analysis. You know, you as moms that have kids with diapers, you know, you have to change the diaper. There's a task analysis to changing the diaper. There's a task analysis to everything we do. Oftentimes we just put it in our mind and we just do it in our mind. But sometimes until we're really good at figuring out all those steps of the task analysis, it is a good idea to write them down. I would like to take about 10 minutes for questions. I have so appreciated you guys taking notes and listening and just being here. It's such an honor for me, and it really humbles me. But before I do that, I would like to thank the Lord. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you so much for this conference, for all that we're learning, for all the people that you've ordained to be here, and for Patch and Tom Garfield and all the people and all the planning that has gone into this. I know, Lord, that your hand has been behind everything. I thank you especially for this workshop, for letting me do it. And I pray, Lord, that you will continue to bless the rest of our day. Thank you for the sunshine. And I pray that everything we say and do is honoring to you. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so if there's any questions, great. And if not, then yes. Sure. And this is not complete. It's just things off the top of my head. Anybody else? Yes. what I do is I have George be the model. So he, at the beginning, the second day I've taught all this, I see that George isn't doing it with everybody else. Then what I do is I say, okay, class, we need to model this behavior, how we go and sharpen our pencil. So George, would you come up here, and first, would you tell me the three things you need to remember when you sharpen your pencil? George tells me, and I say, okay, now George, go ahead and do it. And then later on in the day, I say, okay, now students, I want all of you to remember exactly what George did when he sharpened his pencil. He showed us wonderfully how to do it. He was such a good role model, and I want you to watch George whenever he has to sharpen his pencil today or tomorrow or whenever, because he did such a good job. So then you've raised the standard for George. Now he has to be a model for the other students. Is that okay? Anything else? Okay. Well, thank you very much. And if there's anything else, thank you.